I like actually was kind of depressed at how little comic drawing I was doing. So I like made a point of putting that back into my routine, which is good. I've been trying the Daryl Io method, which is I get one panel of comics done a day, which doesn't sound like a lot, but now it's the end of my first week and I almost finished a page of comics. So, you know,
that also meets his agenda of what comic artists should do, which is relatively modest, which is on purpose, that every comic artist should get paid $1,000 a page and do only one page of comics a week.
Oh, there we go. Why is this guy president?
Yeah, I have also been doing like far less comics than I would like, but I feel like summer, so it's so miserable to get around in the winter in Vancouver. So in my brain, that makes summer running around season. So because the temperature is warm, I have like the constitution of a lizard. So when it gets cold, I can't physically do anything. And so if I need to be like up and moving around and doing something, it has to be during the summer. So I've been like changing around all my furniture, like trying to get stuff out, trying to get new stuff in. So some of the new things I got, I finally caved and got a proper Ergotron arm for my Cintiq. Like one of the really like high-end Ergotron arms. And like, wouldn't you know it, you pay a lot of money for something, it doesn't suck. So I'm very happy because I've tried like so many different things of trying to get, I have a weird posture. So I work in a recliner because the way I learned how to draw was curled up on the couch with my knees up and drawing in my lap, which is not ideal. But I've been like continuing that on, and I'm of an age where my neck no longer can tolerate this. So I've started drawing sitting back in a recliner. And so I needed something to hold the Cintiq in a neck positive place. So I finally got that all installed, which took some doing. It took a few trips to Home Depot because the fasteners they sent me didn't work. Wow. I needed to find new fasteners. And then I needed a ratchet set, and I had a ratchet set. I was like so excited. I'm like, oh, finally, an opportunity to use that ratchet set I've been lugging around through all these moves. I'm so smart and clever. And I even have the bit that I need. But hang on, why don't I have an adapter within this set, even though I have a bit to go into the socket arm? So it took so many trips just to get it installed, but like now it's installed.
Yay.
And it's done.
All right, well, we should start an episode. Jeff, what book are we doing today?
We're doing Roaming by Jillian and Mariko Tamaki, printed by Drawn and Quarterly. No, I think we've done Skim by...
No, we haven't, because I haven't read Skim.
Oh, did we talk about...
Yeah, I also haven't read Skim. Okay. We did this one summer.
Yeah.
Well, that was it, this one summer. Yeah, we did this one summer by Jillian and Mariko Tamaki, and this is their follow-up, and I ran out and I bought it immediately, and they happened to be coming to town for the Writers Festival, and I was really impressed with their presentation, and I love this graphic novel to death. This is like my favorite book that I've read in a long time, so I really wanted to bring it forward to the Trade Waiters and talk about this book that I'm still very excited about. If I'm more excited about after reading it, rereading it. I know we've talked about the Tamakis in the past, so I didn't know if we needed to like reiterate all of the artist details, but they are...
I mean, this one summer was literally our first... No, it was our second episode.
It was like
episode.
Our second or third.
Yeah, because we did seconds first, and then this one summer second. First.
Okay, you're right. Okay, there we go. You're right. Okay, so anyways, Jillian and Mariko are Canadian cartoonists. Jillian does the art and Mariko does the writing. They're both accomplished cartoonists in their own right. Jillian's drawn for other series such as the Super Mutant Magic Academy, and did her own book Boundless. She studied, I think, at the Alberta College of Art and Design, if I remember correctly. And Mariko now currently lives in California and has written a lot of great comics. Another notable one being Laura Dean Keeps Breaking Up With Me with Rosemary Vallejo O'Connell. And Mariko's also written some books for Marvel and DC. In fact, I first encountered Mariko's work in Emiko Superstar, drawn by local Vancouver artist Steve Ralston. And that was part of the failed Minx line of comics, which was DC's attempt to do a young teen girl line. And after giving it, like, I don't know, 3 months of effort, they were like, there's no market for this. And they just canceled everything.
So not so much failed as abandoned.
Yes. But yeah, anyways, I've been a big fan of Mariko's writing since Emiko Superstar, and I've been a big fan of Jillian's work since first seeing it in This One Summer. They have collaborated in the past on their first collaboration was Skim, and they followed that up with This One Summer. And now Roaming is kind of, I don't know, the third part in the Tamaki trilogy, even though they're not really connected to each other. But yeah, I don't know. I was really excited to see this coming out, and I really enjoyed listening to their talk and talk about their process. And I think I embarrassed myself a little bit when I got my autographs, because I just like geeked out and was like, "You guys are so good. You made me want to be a better cartoonist." Which I will say, I mean, my big thing with this book, and you guys can tell me if you agree, but while in the process of reading this book, I found myself constantly going, I need to do better as a cartoonist. I need to work at mastering my craft to the level that Jillian and Mariko have, because like, it is just like such a stunning work. Like, I'm just like, oh man, like there's just so much confidence. There's so much amazing use of the medium. Like, Jillian takes some really big swings, like comic art wise, that I'm just so impressed with. And then Mariko, I don't know, this is maybe like more niche, but like I'm all about just like characters that have absolutely zero superpowers and zero magical abilities, wandering through their life just being normal people for like 300 pages. And there's not really any big like epic arc. It's just like, yeah, it's just like a little snapshot of like how it is to be alive in the world. Like, I don't know, I love that stuff. That's my jam. That's like, I want to make that someday, or like that's what I'm always trying to make. It's like, I love that. I think, I know it's a film genre is mumblecore, but like, I love me a mumblecore comic book too. And I think Mariko has really mastered that kind of storytelling too. So I don't know, both these things together, I'm like 10 out of 10, would recommend. Hopefully you also enjoyed the experience. I'm done
raving. Right, I think that sums up our whole episode. Thank you, everybody. before we go any further, we missed a step.
No. Oh, no.
Ah! That's okay. We don't need to do things in order.
My name is Jeff Ellis, and my character building, I did have a character building question ready. I just didn't read my notes.
You were too excited by comics. That's fair.
I am too excited about comics. Okay. So my question to you guys is, what's your most memorable trip in your 20s?
Very specific. All right. Well, that's easy, because there's one big trip in my 20s that looms larger than anything else, which I have talked about here before, but I will have to talk about again. I'm JD. And after graduating from university the first time, because that's something I've done more than once, I had a degree that said I was good at drawing and wasn't sure what to do with that. So instead, I went to Taiwan and got a job. And I lived there for a year and a half. And it was a big deal, because this is the first time I'd not lived at home. The first time I'd been anywhere that speaks a different language. First time for a lot of things. And Definitely a foundational experience.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'm Jam, and I've done a fair bit of travel. It's hard to wind all the way back to my 20s. I think I was just 20 when I went to Europe. So it was kind of my first big trip on my own. I'm trying to think if it was my first trip to a non-English speaking country other than the one I was born in. I think it was. So it definitely was very formative to me as like the first one I was planning by myself, budgeting by myself, executing by myself. And I ended up going to, I think it was 10 countries in Europe. So I was there for like 3 months. And it was very, very impactful to me because, like, you learn so much about what you can and cannot do as a traveler. You know, you learn so much about, I think it's really impactful to come face to face with things that are so iconic, like the Eiffel Tower and like things in the Louvre, and they're very different from what you expected. Sometimes they're more grand, sometimes they're less grand, but there's always something surprising, I find, when encountering something that looms larger than life in your mind. And I think it was my first experience of culture shock. Like, I remember being in Italy and being in a bit of a struggle trying to find housing for the night, and ended up being taken in by this very, very kind gentleman and given just a little like apartment to rent for the night. And I remember the key turned the opposite way from what I expected. And like at that point in the trip, like I'd already been on the trip for like a month and a half, and it was just like the straw that broke the camel's back because I was tired. I was like coming back at night, and I like it took me like 10 tries to get into the door because the key turned the opposite way of what I expected. And it was just this little moment of culture shock that just sent me crumbling down. And it's like, I just want things to make sense again.
Yeah, I think that's the main takeaway of culture shock is things just don't make sense. They make sense within a context, and as soon as you're out of that context, everybody's assumptions are something entirely different.
And I think it's like the thing with culture shock is that if someone has never experienced it, you might think it's like, whoa, I'm really taken aback. But what I find is that it breaks the heuristic that you use to solve problems. And that's the most frustrating thing. It's like you think, I'm a confident, capable person. I can get through this. And then you're finding that your fundamental assumptions are wrong. And that's what really throws you for a loop.
I'm Jeff Ellis, and my answer, I think a lot of people know I spent like 3 years living in Japan, which is sort of like the answer you probably assume. But to sort of set the table for this book, what I kept thinking about is another memorable trip. My first international flight was going to New York City in 2001. So I was in college, and our illustration teachers took their class every year. This was a tradition. So you do a fundraiser to raise the money, and then you fly to New York and you see all the art galleries in New York with your illustration teacher. And I did not actually appreciate this at the time, but my illustration teacher did not do coach. So when he was doing the booking, he did a business class booking for everyone.
For
So we,
everyone, your
yeah.
entire class? How
For
many
an old,
people?
like 20. So we had to do a lot of fundraising, and like he had a deal with his travel agent, but like you're like, oh wait, we could have raised less money if we flew coach, but we flew business class, Cathay Pacific, and
Vancouver to New York, that's not a cheap flight.
oh, and it was like super swanky. And then like the next flight I took, I was like, wait, why don't I get free socks? Where's my like sleep mask? This is terrible. But anyways, no, it was like a really nice flight. And then I was in New York. I got to go to the Guggenheim and the Met and the MoMA. And then the other sort of really strange extra quirk to this is that because it was January 2001, and I also wanted to do all the like landmarks. So I went to the Statue of Liberty and I went to the top of the Empire State Building. And no one in my class was interested in joining me except for one other person. But I wanted to go to the top of the World Trade Center. And so me and one classmate, we stood in line and we got our photos taken in front of this cheesy photo op with top of the world and like photos of the World Trade Center. And we took the elevator to the top and we walked around and looked out over the city. And I have a bunch of photos. I have photos taken from the top, pointing down, pointing to the side, everywhere, every which direction. And they're very, very strange artifacts now because they're just these tacky vacation photos taken from the top of the World Trade Center. And 8 months later,
those photos are no longer possible to take.
When I went back to New York in like 2017, I made a point of going to Ground Zero because I was like, wow, yeah, okay. Like I was here. There was a big tower here and now it's not there anymore. But like, also I was in my 20s and I was a poor college student. And so I also have memories of like we were staying at the YMCA and I was keeping a jar of peanut butter and a jar of jam on the air conditioner unit outside the window because we had no fridge and that would keep my condiments cold. And so then I was making peanut butter and jam sandwiches for breakfast and lunch. And then I could afford to have like a dinner in New York because New York was expensive. We technically went to a Broadway show and it was the most affordable show we could go to. And the other weird quirk is that this was featured on a podcast recently as the longest running Broadway show, where it was a one woman show that is technically on Broadway. It's in a little tiny building and she's been doing the same performance. And she's the person that takes your ticket. She's the person that directed, wrote, and stars in. And she has one other actor. And that actor's changed a few times. But it's like she just does this one-woman show every night for like, I don't know, 20 years or something. And I was like, hey, I saw that show.
It's hard to find that kind of job security.
Yeah. So anyways, I don't know, this book reminded me of that trip. And so that's sort of my segue, my long meandering segue into roaming.
Well, before we gush about this book, because I assume that's what we're going to do, the story of how I got this book is related to the theme a little bit. Jeff and I were in Toronto for TCAF recently. And like there was a little bit of time before we had to go back to the airport. And so we were like doing the tourist thing, like walking around Toronto, looking at stuff. And we went to The Beguiling, and Jeff had already decided this was going to be the next book we would do, but I didn't have a copy. They had a copy of Roaming at The Beguiling, and it was signed, like just sitting on the shelf signed. So, of course, I bought it. And I don't know, I just felt like after the fact feels very, like in a very appropriate way to get this particular book.
Yeah, that's very like deep in the comics scene to get it like at TCAF from The Beguiling.
Yeah,
that's pretty nice.
That's a better origin story than my copy. Mine even has my name written in it.
I just got the Kobo edition. Although I was very pleased that there was a Kobo edition. Like,
I'm glad to hear edition. That.
Yeah, because it's not on Kindle,
right?
Which is where I usually expect graphic novels to be these days. As much as I don't like that situation. So I was disappointed. I'm like, I prefer to get digital books first. And so I had to do a bit of searching around and yeah, Kobo edition worked fine. It was good.
I'm glad to hear that though, because I think historically with Drawn and Quarterly books, it's not always been possible to get a digital version. So
they have been reluctant to put out digital versions. Yeah, for sure.
There's one feature that I'm curious if the digital edition has, that the print edition has, which is, and I don't know if Jonathan's looked at this or not, but
yeah.
If you open up the dust jacket, there is a whole inside selection of art of Fiona in all these like fashion outfits. And then the actual cover of the book is Fiona's stockings. That's maybe a little.
It does not seem to be in the digital edition.
All right. Little print Easter egg. Not crucial to your understanding of the story or appreciation of the work, though. I bring that up because they mentioned it at the book talk, and it was really wild watching 100 people pull their book dust jackets apart and be like, "Oh, wow!"
Yeah, I mean, this book was great. It's, I don't know. I mean, I knew it would be good because the tabaxis are always good, but it just, It even since this one summer, it feels like it raises the bar of what comics is possible or what's possible in comics. Just the level of skill, the level of sort of being able to sort of play with the balance between images and words and not have the thread of the story get lost. It's the most impressive part about it is the skill of the execution of the medium.
Yeah, I agree. There was a lot of really beautiful gestures in this book, and I did really enjoy reading it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and like even though I think Jeff, you're right that it's sort of not very much happens in this book. Like it's I still feel that sort of the there's still attention to it. Like I by the halfway through this book, I really want a certain outcome with these characters. And I know that because of the type of story it is, I'm not gonna get everything I want. And so there's that tension of like, what's gonna happen? Like, are we gonna see the end of a friendship? Are Zoe and Danny still gonna be friends at the end of this story? And like I feel like the ending was very satisfying and it sort of kept true to the characters, kept true to sort of the things that had happened in the story. And even though the stakes are small, like they feel important when you're in this story.
Yeah, the whole arc has this very it happens at what happens at Vegas kind of vibe, where like a lot of travel, it feels like a capsule. Especially these young trips that are very formative to you, it feels like it's a little capsule, you know, where you kind of had to be there to really understand the context of the stories that you're telling, and it shook up your life and it shook up the relationships of the people that you went with. But I like the way that it just kind of ended abruptly because coming home kind of feels like that. And then you kind of slot back into your regular life, but you're like, oh, but what about New York? You know, and it does like it changes you indelibly, and it will change the relationships of the people that you're with indelibly. But to all the people around you were just absent for a week, you know, and it doesn't change anything at all.
Yeah, I feel like that it also ends at a point where we know everything we need to know. Like we don't need to see them get on the plane and go home because we've sorted out at that point, or at least sorted out enough that you can infer, like where are these friendships headed in the future? Like we know that Zoe and Danny are probably gonna be okay. They're gonna see each other again. That friendship has been saved. Fiona is gonna probably go off and do her own thing, and that was always how that was gonna go. Like we don't need more information than that. That's I think a good example of like the level of skill at work here, where we just get to that point where, like, I understand the ending, and then that's it. You don't need more.
Yeah, I like that idea of just is like just enough, right? It's like you don't need to see them at Coney Island to know kind of like where everything's gonna end up. Like it's, you know, like leaving it on that train was like a nice kind of final note, right? I really like this, and I hope one day I can write a character as good as Fiona as a character. She's a terrible character. She's a terrible person, but she's a fun character.
See, one of the things I liked about these characters though is that I was expecting Fiona to just be terrible, but I don't think she's as simple as that. I think all three of them are very sort of, we see all of their positives and their negatives, and the story is kind of the result of those interacting with each other. Like, I feel like there's a lot we're not being told about Fiona that we're kind of given hints about why she is the way she is. And I like that at the end, there isn't really any kind of hostility there because she just is who she is, and this is how this is gonna go. And they are still like trying to remember now. Yeah, she does go with them to Coney Island, right? Yeah, which is like there was a point where she was deciding maybe I'm not gonna do that. And then she does, which is like that's as much as you're gonna get out of Fiona. That's what she's capable of giving to them.
I mean, that was kind of like the, I don't know, I felt like that was sort of the olive branch. She was originally just like, I'm gonna go do my own thing. You guys are lame. And then it was like, oh, well, if you're going to Coney Island, here's some like travel tips, you know, and it's just like, okay, you still kind of want to be part of the group.
At least for the rest of the length of this trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Fiona is someone who came in with a lot of baggage, like a lot more baggage than the other two characters necessarily. And at the beginning, it comes off as this kind of maturity, you know, like a worldliness. She has all the tricks to get, you know, to get you to navigate safely in New York and to get you into a bar and to make sure your drink is safe and this and that. And I can see how a young person who is still like finding their feet in the world would be really impressed by that. But getting those skills at that age comes at a cost, you know, it comes with a lot of other experiences that are not said so explicitly. And I think that carries through. So like, yeah, Fiona is a very flawed person, but also someone who's like, you think of it like a structure, you know, you put a lot of weight on a structure before the foundation is really cured. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't really have the foundation she needs to carry the weight of whatever it is she's carrying without doing damage to the people around her. And I think she very much wants to be. I think like what I read in Fiona is a really deep jealousy of the innocence of the other two characters. You know, it's like, I wish I could bumble through the world the way you do, you know, with still having the light in your eyes of like, well, I want to go to Central Park. It's so amazing. You know, she's already jaded even at this young age. And I think that's very interesting.
That's just an interesting observation. Like, I feel like that fits with a lot of the ways that she interacts with the other two, where she's constantly kind of like putting them down a little bit, but then dialing it back. Like, oh, I went too far. Like, no, I'll say something nice now. Where she wants to keep this kind of distance, but also, like she says at the start, like, oh, my original plan is I was just going to like get here and then ditch you, and then we won't see each other for the rest of the trip. And she doesn't do that because she wants to have that, like, she wants to be there. She wants to be part of this, but she also doesn't at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she's come in as a third wheel, you know, like Zoe and Danny came in with a pre-existing relationship that, you know, so like Fiona has been friends with Danny at their university, and then like coming into a connection with someone from high school, so from Danny's past. And so that reunion, that relationship seemed to have been a lot stronger. And so it's easy to be intimidated by that, especially if you're someone who struggles in the relationships category. And then it gets completely subverted with the adolescence, like, a budding romance now between Fiona and Zoe. And it gets very complicated very quickly. But I thought that whole arc, that relationship rang super, super true of being like completely swept away by your hormones and making all sorts of poor decisions and poor mistakes to the people around you, especially in a travel context. I've definitely had that happen to me, and it's a rough one to deal with, you know, and it kind of goes back to before you have the maturity to really kind of hold these big emotions, it can really sweep you away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like that, like the decisions, like in the moment, that all the characters make so much sense. Like, so I mean, Zoe is kind of swept off her feet a little bit by Fiona, kind of just goes along with this. And there isn't really any point where it's clear that she's deciding to snub Danny or to like do anything against Danny. Like, she's just doing things that only seem to have positive results. But then the sum total of that is that then she's been ignoring her friend that she hasn't seen for months. And only when she gets called out on it does she realize, oh, wait, that's not actually very good. Like, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And then on the flip side of it, Danny is, when this all comes down and, like, Danny is telling Zoe about, like, how this makes her feel, like, she basically seems to be kind of, like, ending their friendship, which doesn't seem like a fair reaction, but it's, like, fair emotionally. And like she, like after that, she like does the work to sort of rebuild this, and like so she doesn't lose her friend over this. But it's just, yeah, like all of their decisions make sense. They don't all have good results, They do cause problems, but you can see the story from any of their point of view. And that's I can't think of any other stories that are like as balanced as that, where there isn't just one character who's the point of view character.
Yeah, all three characters have their own complexity. They all feel realistic and they interact with each other in a really realistic way. What I see in Danny is like the trip being an awakening of, oh, we're really not in high school anymore. That's kind of what I get into it, because like the way that she carries herself, you know, she kind of, you know, in a type A kind of way, it's got a very high school energy of like, okay, I've organized the itinerary and we have to see X and Y and Z. And especially because she's going to see her high school friend, I think she wants to carry that kind of high school energy. But the challenges that they meet and the interpersonal things that happen between them, it forces her to recognize that, especially like it seems like Joey has changed more in the intervening time since high school than Danny necessarily has. And it's painful to recognize that gap. Someone that you used to be really close to. And it's like, oh, you've changed as a person though, and I'm not sure we're on the same wavelength anymore. So it definitely feels like a post-graduation kind of feeling. And if they're 20, this would be like just first year, right? Second year?
Yeah, first year.
First year. Yeah. So like, even if you've been in university for a little while, university is a little bit of a bubble. Where yeah. it's like the third trimester. It's like high school plus, you know, until you're out in the world and really paying real rent, you know, like your off campus housing and your things like that.
Yeah. I think the like the introduction, like when Danny comments on Zoe's hair being short, and just like even like later when Danny's like got an old photo when Zoe had long hair and Zoe's really not okay with Fiona seeing her with long hair, like you can sort of tell like, oh no, like there's Zoe's got like an identity that is like very like a new identity that Danny's not picking up on, that's not like, you know, clicking with. And like I thought that was a good way of just demonstrating some of that gulf of like, oh well, like you used to be okay with this in high school, like why are you not okay with this now, you know. I think I've definitely had that experience, that dynamic when running into old friends from high school.
Yeah, and even when they're trying to reconcile on the balcony, I think it's Danny imagining Zoe with longer hair again.
Is it?
Probably.
Like, I love that scene. I'm not, I don't know, I'm going to have to look at it again to see if
It definitely could be open to interpretation. But it was an interesting choice, because I like, is it just the fact that it's the past and it's like imagining your self-image from the past?
It felt, I mean, this is obviously subjective, but it felt to me like it was a shared experience of both of them falling back into their old roles of like, this is why we have this connection. This is who we were in high school. These bonds still exist. Even though we're kind of like, the stuff that's happening is simultaneously a flashback and also the present. And it's just, I've never seen anyone do that before in comics. It's just like, it took me a split second to realize what was happening, like why they suddenly look different. And I love that realization, that like not knowing and then knowing, like the ability of a cartoonist to like create that experience in a reader is like, that's impressive. And I was trying to think, like when they were talking about this old photo of Zoe with long hair, we don't actually see the photo, do we?
No.
So this is the first, like, that's basically our reference point. And then when we see her with long hair, it's like, oh, this is not her in the present now.
Yeah.
So this is the only time we see her for, like, quote unquote, for real in this mode.
Yeah. And it's interesting that this is like a scene in which like the two characters are getting stoned. So then it's sort of like they're kind of in a state of being unreliable narrators. So like, just like the fact that the scene gets a little bit like, I don't know, it's like, I even think it gets a little psychedelic where like, you know, people change sizes, like She gets really big in the page, which I know it's maybe more of just a transition without a panel, but like there's multiple times where Jillian does these like just changes in scale, like even like when they're walking through Times Square or they're in the museum, there's just like drawings of varying sizes that are kind of montaged together with no panel borders, and you know, it's sort of letting you interpret from the drawings what you will.
Yeah, it's like collage.
Yeah. And I did at the, I will say at the writer's talk, this scene came up, and apparently Mariko did not have that in the script. And so this was an artistic choice from Jillian that she thought the conversation on the fire escape was boring if it was just drawn in the present. And so it was just like an artistic choice to do this sort of flashback illustration while the actual dialogue was still sort of grounded in the present. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see how it visually would start to be stale after like six pages, certainly. Fire escape. Yeah. Also, fire escapes are a pain in the ass to draw. So,
and it's like for honor, such an emotionally important scene, like it needed something.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, I know I was down on Fiona, but like, I also love Fiona as a character. And I agree with you guys that like everyone has their good and bad qualities, right? And it's like, you know, Fiona's a really fun character. And I think like, I don't know, I think I recognize a little bit of my own contradictions from my 20s, you know, where you're just very like, oh, like, like, this all this art is so pretentious, like I'm so above it all, or like, oh, it's all colonialism anyways, so and then also in the same breath to be like, oh, I'm so excited to go to the M&M store, look how tacky it is, this is amazing, like I think I am able to hold both of those things in myself, and so it's nice to see that represented in like a character, you know.
Yeah, Fiona's very confident. I feel like Fiona really knows who she is, where the other two have a lot to figure out.
To a certain extent, but then I think part of that is just sort of a persona she's built for herself.
I think
she's a lot more
persona.
Fragile on the inside.
I would agree with that. Yeah. So she knows how to get through.
Yeah.
She has learned what she needs to do to get through and is confident in that shell that she's built for herself, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what
but
was...
She won't let anyone in. Not really.
What was fun about Fiona was sort of the fact that, yeah, she has kind of a front, but then when Zoe or Danny would kind of like poke at like a crack in the facade, then like, she would like go on the defensive, or like she would just like respond with like a contradiction, you know, like she'd sort of make a big speech about, you know, I don't know, consumerism. And then later when they point out like, well, aren't you just doing a bunch of consumerism? Then she just like has like a completely contradictory response to that, but she's not going to like concede that maybe she has issue. Like she's not even concede that there's things she maybe needs to give more thought to. She's just like, oh, well, I was joking earlier. Now this is what I really feel, you know, like.
Yeah. It's just sort of like this dance between, we don't really know who she is. I mean, maybe she doesn't know, like at those moments, maybe she doesn't know like who she is really. She's just got like these really strong ideas. It could be this. It must be this. I'm going to say it's this.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know. It's just like even the kind of climax of the story, you know, Fiona's kind of stuck in this contradiction, right? Where, she's like drunk and out of money, and she has nowhere to turn, but she goes back to the hostel, and, you know, Danny and Zoe are like trying to like pay off the cab driver and like sort out this problem she's caused. But then at the same time, she's just like yelling at them and like, don't touch me. I don't want anything to do with you. It's like she's coming back to them for help, but then simultaneously like slapping their hand away and being resentful of it at the same time, you know, which is like, again, a very human, you know, interaction. It's like, oh yeah, like I've been on both sides of that equation, you know, like I've probably been needing help and like resentful of getting the help, and I've probably been the person helping people that are also simultaneously just being like, no, I don't need your help. You know,
there's that scene, there's a couple of parts of this book where there's just like juxtapositions that are just add so much to the story. Like there's that scene where she's like saying, I don't want any help, like don't touch me. And then the very next panel, I think, is like a scene from a nature documentary of trees, like a tree canopy, doing that thing that trees do where they get close to each other, but they don't touch.
Oh,
so there, and then the documentary is about ants and how much ants need each other and how much they can get done when they have all their friends.
There was some really good juxtapositions. And I think reading it a second time, it was like I picked up on some things I missed the first time, like when they're at the museum and Danny is kind of separated from Zoe and Fiona because they've gone off to go make out in the butterfly room or whatever. And there's a school field trip walking by, and one of the teachers is like, do you have your buddy? And it's like, but the camera is on Danny's face, but then there's a speech balloon going off in the distance, like, do you have your buddy? And I was just it kind of went by me the first time. At the second time, I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. Like, that's such a great little, like, subconscious thing.
Yeah. That was one of the other ones I noticed like that. There was, I'm going to see if I can find the other one. But so, yeah, keep going.
Well, I mean, this isn't like a juxtaposition, but something I completely didn't notice the first time that I'm just going to ask if you guys noticed, but when Zoe and Fiona go in the common room at the hostel, Fiona pulls a puzzle out and then she starts peeling the image off the puzzle pieces. And then she crumples up all the like images and then she puts the like blank pieces back in the box and puts the box away. And the first time I read this, I think it was just focusing on the dialogue and it just slipped by me that she was like defacing this puzzle. And it's like the second time through, I was like, oh my God, like this is such a character building moment for Fiona. Like, of course she's destroying the jigsaw puzzle.
I can't remember.
Hey, I found another one. There's okay, so it's the scene where Danny's upset at having been essentially abandoned and Zoe finally gets in touch with her to reconnect. Fiona doesn't want to go, so it's just Zoe running to get to where Danny is. And the next panel is like the Alice in Wonderland statue in Central Park. So it's like a bunch of kids like playing around the statue. And it feels like it's like, this is the part, this is the reason that Zoe is running to where Danny is, because they were childhood friends. So it's just sort of like ambience. Like here's the emotional context delivered to you via like a scene of a thing that just happens to be happening. Like, yeah. I feel like there's kind of like in this book, the thing I'm most impressed by is that they've figured out that the main tool of comics is these juxtapositions. Like, that's straight back to Scott McCloud. Like, you put one panel next to another panel and meaning is created by putting those two things next to each other. And like, there's so many times in this book where like, it's just, there's a level of storytelling that's delivered just by putting two panels next to each other that wouldn't be related to each other without the context of the story around them.
Yeah.
And you're able to really focus in and emphasize the aspect of that juxtaposition that you want the reader to take away.
Yeah. And then even just like, there's so many like empty panels and blank spaces too. Like,
yeah, the confidence of leaving space empty. That's what I envy.
Yes. Yes.
Which you wouldn't be able to tell by looking at anything I've ever done. But like, I'm impressed when someone cannot draw every brick.
Yeah.
like, how do you do that?
Like, a lot of cartoonists would just be like, this page is not finished. And yet, like, Jillian's able to just be like, no, like, it can just have a giant white square where a panel should exist. But we don't need a panel there. It's okay.
It's the power of curation.
Yeah.
So, like, what you leave is more impactful when you brush other things away that distract from it. So it's the process of deletion. It's editing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good analogy. It's like I was trying to think, okay, so this is if juxtaposition is the core element of comics, that's the thing that makes comics work. What's the analogy in another medium? And like I think for film it would be editing. Like
there's
editing is
juxtaposition
what
in
film
film
is.
Too. Yeah.
Is that?
There's juxtaposition in film all the time.
Well, I mean, yeah, but it's not as powerful as the like the editing of the timeline or whatever you call it. I don't know film.
It would be okay. So I would say actually, like, juxtaposition has its fairly straightforward equivalent. Like, you can have dialogue showing over B-roll, you know, like that happens a lot. And like what you choose as your secondary image while this scene is happening, that's a very direct. But I don't know if there's an equivalent of this like blank space in film. Like, you can't just have blank film.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
I mean,
like
you
having a
could,
blank
but it
screen
would be
is
very
not the same.
confusing. Yeah, it would
Yeah.
be very confusing. So there are times, like even in, I think it's the ending of The Sopranos, where they do the ending without dialogue, where they cut all the sound. I actually have never watched it, but
no, wait. I have watched it. No, they're playing music and there's no dialogue, but then it just fades to black in the middle of the song.
Okay.
And there's debate about the meaning of this, but there's earlier conversations about how if you get shot, you don't see it coming, you just die. And so like there's an implication that because it just fades to black suddenly, that
yeah,
Tony was potentially just shot in that moment, but we'll not know because we're seeing things from his perspective.
Right. So this is just like a very simple example, and it's very confusing and divisive to the audience, right? Whereas this type of blank space isn't as controversial as the comics, let's say.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You could read the comic and not notice the empty space, I think is the difference.
Yeah.
Like if
I'm
you have a
thinking.
blank frame on your movie, people are going to say, what's going on?
Yeah. I'm thinking of Scott McCloud's The Sculptor, where there are like, there's a very impactful, like, I think there's three blank pages in a row, which is to great effect. I won't spoil it, but, and of course, Scott McCloud is strong enough to flag something like that, but not everyone would be.
Yeah. But I mean, like, yeah, I think I find like the blank spaces are sometimes an invitation to the reader to pause, right? It's sort of like, that's kind of my outlook, is like the blank pages or the blank spaces are just sort of like, here's a scene, these characters are like, something's just taken place. And it's sort of inviting the reader to just take a second and reflect on that panel they just looked at before they go to the next panel, as opposed to like a six grid where you're just kind of panel to panel to panel to panel to panel, where if you go panel to blank, it's kind of like, okay, well, let's think about panel one for just a little bit longer before we go to panel three.
I
If
mean,
we can
maybe
the blank space.
I don't think it's as direct as that, though. Like,
right.
I think this is the difference between comics and film. If you have a blank screen in film, it's probably the passage of time. In comics, it might be the passage of time, but it's not going to tell us how much time, if it's time at all.
Right.
I think that's sort of the most obvious interpretation. Most of the time, it's something like that. But not necessarily.
Oh no, I don't think a panel necessarily means it's extending the time. I guess it's just like
it does change the focus. I think you're right.
Yeah.
It changes the focus. It puts focus on the panels that are remaining, makes them more important. But I don't think it's the kind of thing that you could then, like, if you were going to write the novelization of Roaming, I don't think there would be a single way to take those blank panels and then reinterpret them into prose.
Right. Right.
They don't translate. They are comics specific.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I would want to read the novelization of Roaming.
No.
I think the comics are too important.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I may tolerate the film version.
It wouldn't be the same though at
It
all.
would not be the same.
No.
I don't think it would carry as much emotional weight as a short film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or a
Yeah.
film.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, I don't know. It's like there's something very, I think this speaks to maybe why I really think this is such a great graphic novel, because I think it does things that you really can do with comics that, like, were this prose, it wouldn't be a one-to-one. Were this film, it wouldn't be a one-to-one. Were this animation, it wouldn't be a one-to-one. It's like it is just kind of singularly a comic. It's really living in the medium, taking advantage of the medium, you know, like it should be experienced as a comic. It like does not need to be reinterpreted into a different medium, right? It's taking advantage of the medium it's in.
Yeah, and I wonder, like I feel like this is a comic that benefits from people having a high degree of comics literacy, which we all do. I wonder how it reads to someone who is not well versed in the medium. I like that the Tamakis are giving us the credit of like trusting us to understand what they're doing. I hope that a reader who doesn't have as much exposure to comics would also stay around for the ride and get out of it what the story is. But like, I'm not that person, so I can't say for sure that it would.
I think it's probably legible. I think it's definitely legible, and I feel like they would get enough out of the story to be like, there's enough just in plot and dialogue, and the plot and dialogue are interpretable. So I don't think a new reader would necessarily have any issue. They may not get as many layers out of it.
Yeah, you might get a situation where you have like with the end of The Sopranos, where like people are then debating online, what did that mean? Like, why was there a blank thing at the end?
Or like,
that doesn't
not
make
even
it a bad show. That doesn't mean that people didn't like that show.
Yeah, it's just like, or that Gundam meme that they have where someone is looking at it and they're like, wow, cool robots. And like the point going over their head is like, war is terrible.
Right.
Yeah, I think as a writer, as a cartoonist, you have to sort of accept that you can't control the reading experience. Like, you're going to get readers who like see your Gundam show and then don't understand, like, and then go and like vote for like extending a war or whatever, because they didn't get it. I mean, that's just life. That's how art works, right?
That's how art works. That's right.
I now feel like I need to just like acknowledge the fact that apparently The Boys season 4 is the season where everyone on the right realized that The Boys was making fun of them this whole time, but they've only just realized and turned on the show this season.
Visual literacy is tough. I teach like critical literacy to students, and like it's an uphill battle. Like, even for the best intentioned people, like it takes experience to really get what an author is trying to tell you.
Yeah.
But for those who can, they will be richly rewarded in this book.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I mean, just to take it back to this book, I will mention my partner, who is not as versed in comics as I am. She does read comics, but not as many comics as I do. She is very literate and like could probably tell me a few things about books. But, you know, she really loved this book. In fact, she read all of the Tamaki's work back to back to back before the author's talk we went to. And so she's a big fan of Tamaki collaborations. So she got a lot out of it. And
all right, good. Good to know.
And I think probably also someone would be affected by the layered choices without necessarily being able to pick up on what and why.
Yeah.
Because it's so deftly handled. Like, this book is so well constructed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she also missed Fiona destroying the puzzle the first time. So,
I mean, that's a small detail. So,
yeah. Okay.
You said you missed it the first time. So, you
know, no, that's, I was meaning like, I missed it. She also missed it. Yeah. So, when I read it a second time, pointed it out, she was like, oh, I was like, yeah. Like, there's all these layers to it. So, the second time reading this, I finally understood the title. So I want, maybe you guys can tell me if you like picked up on the title right away, but like the first time reading this, I was like, oh, roaming, you know, you're roaming through New York City, you're traveling, you know, going on a voyage, like nice. And then like the second time reading this, the whole crux of the issue where Danny has left the group and they don't know where she is, and Zoe's like beside herself with anxiety. And the solution to the problem is that she has to turn on roaming on her cell phone. And she's been afraid to turn on roaming because it was going to cost her a lot of money because she's with a Canadian cell phone provider.
Also,
And
it's
like,
like 2009. Like,
yes.
does roaming still exist in 2024?
Oh, yeah.
I guess I just haven't been anywhere in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, roaming's a
Okay.
thing. Roaming's a thing. But yeah, so it's like, I don't know. Like, it just the second time through, I was like, right, it's called roaming because, like, it's all about just got her phone, it's got to be on roaming so they can talk to each other to communicate. Like, it just had like galaxy brain.
See, now I'm wondering if Americans are going to get that because, like, that's not something they ever have to deal
now, some
Some
Americans do leave the country. Think of all the
That's
poor Americans who had to come to TCAF and learn what roaming is.
there you go. Okay,
Yeah. How
one more
now?
thing I want to say, make sure I don't forget to mention is, like, I love how well this illustrates the obsession Eastern Canadians have with New York. Like, I lived in Toronto for a year, and like, let me tell you, there is nothing that Torontonians like talking about more than going to New York.
Interesting. I'm going to specify that that's Toronto then, because I grew up in Montreal
Okay.
and I do not remember this.
That tracks. That makes sense. Like, Montreal doesn't care. But
Montreal is like, we're
Toronto
already in the best
absolutely
place.
does.
Like,
Toronto
go somewhere.
wishes every day that they could be more like New York.
Yes. Well, I was talking to I was at TCAF talking to someone from PEI, and like, you know, he's got no dog in the race, but like I was just like, yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, if Vancouverites are really being honest with themselves, like we're jealous of Toronto and we wish we were Toronto.
100%.
And like, and then like, you know, he was like, yeah, but like Toronto just wishes it was New York. I'm like, yeah, that's probably true too. And I'm like, really, at the end of the day, the real best city that Canada has is Montreal. And I'm going to stick by that. I think Montreal's maybe the best city that Canada has, and it's just because Montreal doesn't have anything to prove. Montreal just sits there and they're just like, yeah, man, whatever. It's all good.
Why would
We're
we want to
good.
be in New York or
You
Montreal?
know, you don't need to change. We are Montreal. We're good.
I have a lot of affection. I grew up in Montreal. I have a lot of affection for it, but it is a city with its own flaws.
I have never been
Right.
there. I've also never been
Montreal's
to New
not a
York.
perfect
Highly
city.
recommend. Highly
Montreal's not
recommend.
a perfect city, but it's a hell of a fun city to visit. I
It is
really
a
enjoyed my
fun
time
city.
there. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a fun city and it holds its own. Yeah. So I half my family is from New York. So despite growing up on the East Coast, I have a bit of a different relationship with New York, and it was very I had a lot of nostalgia of like all of these things that I visited over and over again. Like, oh yeah, there's this thing, there's that thing. Oh, cool, you know. And I just wanted to give a shout out to the conversation with the older lady in Central Park. It's like that's a New York experience. Like when people say like you can't really explain what it's like to live in New York unless you've lived in New York, and it's like that type of experience really encapsulates it. That conversation with the woman who was like, let me tell you my life story and give you a bunch of advice, you know.
I
I
love
made
that
you
dog. Like
with my tiny
Fajita.
dog.
Don't
Yeah.
touch my dog. He's not nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that lady, that conversation with that lady is great. I love that. I love the little joke in that where she's talking about, oh yeah, I used to date this writer, or I was married to this writer, and like he left me for another woman, and like his name was whatever, I forget what his name. She tells Danny the name, and she goes, oh, I don't know who that is. She goes, exactly. Like,
He's
yeah,
a
I mean,
bum, that's who he is.
yeah. I don't know if you guys read in the like the thanks in the book, but I was going to mention that Jillian does a big shout out to the people on Flickr who meticulously documented New York City in the time period that this book was set. So apparently, Jillian spent a lot of time on Flickr pulling images so that she could get the M&M store circa, I don't know, whatever, 1999 or whatever, whenever, I can't remember the exact time this story was set, but just
2009.
Oh, that was 2009. Okay, but just like,
well, it was spot on.
Yeah, like getting all the locations just spot on, all the backgrounds. Apparently she even had an opportunity. She was flying. She had a layover. So she ran to whatever gate in the airport to like get a photo of the boarding gate, because that's the one thing that wasn't on Flickr or something. Like,
that's, I don't know if people know this about comics, but this is how you do it. If you're trying to draw a real location, you just go on the internet and find every photo you can of that place.
Yes.
Last time I had to do that was for the border crossing, the Peace Arch.
Yeah.
And like, it's hard to find photos of that for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't think they like you taking photos in there.
Google Maps is a good tool. Flickr. I'm gonna dive into Flickr some more. Yeah.
You probably do final thoughts.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. Recommend. I would recommend this to almost anyone. It was a very enjoyable read.
Yeah, no, this was like top tier comics. This is the I think when we did this one summer, we said this is the pinnacle of the medium right now, but we're not at the top for what will come in the future. And like, again, same thing. Like, this is amazing. This is the top level of skill in comics right now. But like, you know, the Tamakis are still around. I'm sure they're going to make more comics, and like, so will lots of other people too.
Yeah. No, this was, I think this is like my favorite graphic novel until the Tamakis put out another graphic novel. I don't know. It was just a real pleasure to talk to you guys about this, because like, not only do I think this is a good book, but this feels like a cartoonist comic book. Like, because I think there's things about the storytelling and the juxtaposition that we can talk about that like I could not talk to my partner about, you know, because she's not intimately familiar with the creation of the comics. She just reads them. And so to talk to some other people that make the comics, there's like a whole other layer of discussion that I'm really glad to get into. I love talking about this book. Love this book. I can talk about it some more. But last thing I'll mention is at TCAF, they unveiled a series of postage stamps for independent Canadian cartoonists. And one was for Seth. One was for Chester Brown. One was for Jillian and Mariko Tamaki together. And I'm totally blanking on the last one. But anyways, they did a series of stamps that I can't think of two cartoonists that deserve to be on a stamp more than the Tamakis for Canadian cartooning.
Yeah, so, that's pretty cool. I've been to cartoonists on stamps.
That's enough of me gushing. So let's do some shout outs to other people's work.
I've been continuing to read Witch Hat Atelier by...
You stole my thing. Oh my God.
This is not the first time this has happened.
We are on the same wavelength, dude. All right, I'll think something else.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can compare notes to see how far we've gotten. I have read now up to volume 4 of Witch Hat Atelier. It's still good. Still like it. It's great cartooning. It's like really, really good world building. That's as far as I've got, though. How is your Witch Hat Atelier journey going?
I'm up to 8, and it keeps getting better and better.
Oh.
I really, really enjoy Witch Hat Atelier, and I also wanted to shout it out because we did an episode on it. I think we only did
first book 1 and 2. Yeah.
But it continues to stack up and go deeper and deeper. And I'm like constantly at the library being like, is the next one in? Is the next one?
Okay.
It's really good.
I need to get back to that because I really enjoyed the first 2 volumes. I want to read more. As usual, my brain's finally caught up, and it was Michelle Rabagliati is the 4th Canadian cartoonist honored. Overall, pretty nice set of stamps. Anyways, okay.
Oh, okay. Hang on. I have another piece of Trade Waiters follow-up. Nina Matsumoto was on an episode with us, and her shout-out was Disco Elysium. And being one of the slowest gamers in the world, I finally finished Disco Elysium, and I also can confirm that that is a really good game.
Oh, nice. Right on. Okay. Oh man, I'm gonna check that out. All right, well, I was gonna shout out a book I picked up in TCAF. So in addition to seeing Canadian stamps getting inaugurated, I picked up Old Caves, which is by Uncivilized Press. And it's a single creator, Tyler Landry from PEI. And yeah, it's just got a nice, short, simple little graphic novel. And it won a Doug Wright Award. So I was there to see him pick up his pigskin Pete hat. So definitely check it out if you can. Old Caves. What is our next book going to be?
Our next book is My Aunt is a Monster by Ramina Yi.
The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. And thanks to Sleuth for the music. You can find us wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.